Come on, say it with me now, would you? The stock market is not... All y'all take it from there, all right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, I do believe, the 20th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, let's see where we stand, shall we? Late of a pandemic July with the general mood of this economy. Corporate profits last week and this, as we told you, coming in quite nicely, thanks. Housing starts, we learned today, up more than expected in June. Nice relief there for a very tight market. Speaking of markets, well, that whole yesterday thing might as well never have happened for what today's session brought. See, also, that thing I always say. Oh, hey, also, the recession's over. Been over for a while, actually. The people who get to decide this stuff, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, say the bottom of the business cycle, that is the end of the recession, happened in April of last year. It lasted just 2 months, easily the shortest on record, but it sure hasn't felt that way for a whole lot of Americans. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Ask Mike Schwitter if the recession feels over to him.
No.
He's an actor in New York, on tour with Les Miserables before the pandemic.
Broadway, off-Broadway, none of that really has come back 100% yet.
But Schwitter is not the National Board of Economic Research, which defines recessions differently. Matthew Luzzetti is chief U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank.
The typical way that we think about a recession is looking at the movement from the peak in economic activity before it down to the trough, meaning the low point in terms of economic activity.
The end of a recession is not when things are good, but when they're actually at rock bottom and turning around. For this recession, that was in April, and it was pretty low. Constance Hunter is chief economist at KPMG.
This is the deepest recession since World War II.
Last year, unemployment went from 3.5% to 14.8% in 2 months. It's now lower, but still high, 5.9%.
We're in the recovery phase. That doesn't mean we have recovered.
But that recovery has been incredibly quick, and so was the recession itself. Compared to the Great Recession, which lasted 18 months and whose recovery took nearly 10 years, this recession lasted just 2 months. Jason Furman teaches economics at Harvard.
That's faster than most recoveries are, in part because of the vaccines and the huge fiscal policy response.
The economy, measured in GDP, will be as if there never was a pandemic at all by the end of this year, according to Deutsche Bank's Luzzetti. In terms of employment, KPMG's Hunter says we'll be fully recovered by the middle of 2022. Oh, and Mike Schwitter, the actor, he's in real estate until theaters reopen. He says business is booming. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We have been talking with some regularity about food prices on this program and how they are going up. Insert here your favorite supply chain parameter as to why. You, though, have probably noticed rising prices at the grocery store, even though those grocery retailers kind of wish you wouldn't. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
A little tip for your next grocery trip.
Beware of shrinkflation.
Mark Bergen is a marketing professor at the University of Minnesota, and what he's talking about is one of the easiest things a manufacturer can do when the cost of making something goes up. Put a little less of whatever it is inside the package. They might also change the packaging itself, offer a smaller tub of hummus that costs more per ounce, or bundle ketchup and mustard together so shoppers think less about the itemized cost, or change the actual package design to make the proportions just right.
Because there's nothing worse than having it's the same bag and you just reduce the chips and you just look in there and you go, what happened?
Retailers have tactics too, but they don't have a lot of control over the products themselves, so they have to be strategic about it. Phil Lempert is a food industry analyst and runs supermarketguru.com.
They don't want to have sticker shock when somebody goes into the supermarket. So what they do is, I don't want to say they disguise price increases, but they try to lessen the burden.
They'll run fewer sales or increase prices and then put them on sale. They'll rearrange shelves to display cheaper generic brands. Because Kasum Alawadi, a professor of marketing at Dartmouth College, says ultimately,
consumers really don't remember what prices they paid for products.
There are exceptions, like a gallon of milk. Grocers might raise the price of half and half to make up for it. Because
the more involved you are in the purchase of any product, the more you're going to notice the price.
Which means consumers who want to save will have to put in the effort. Those who keep and compare receipts and are more flexible with the brands they buy will see a lower bill at checkout. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, as I said, that drubbing equities took yesterday? Never mind, the three major indices did a one-day round trip down and back. Honestly, just watch the bond market, people. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, here's the supply-demand story that does not end with supply chain problems. We've talked cars on the show a time or two in the past, maybe 5-6 months now, both new and used. Demand has been huge. Supply has been lacking. Prices have done what prices do in those circumstances. But now the supply of used cars, at least, is back to normal. That's according to Manheim Consulting, which keeps tabs on that market. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has the story.
As anyone who's looked for a used car lately can probably tell you, there have not been many options. Jonathan Smoke, an economist at Cox Automotive, says inventory was especially low in April, 30% below what it was in 2019.
But in recent weeks, we've seen inventory tick up and we've seen the sales pace slow. So as a result, we're about back to normal.
One of the main reasons why?
The high prices of used cars have brought a lot of cars out of the woodwork.
Sam Fiorani is at Auto Forecast Solutions.
People who have second or third or fourth cars are getting rid of them to cash in on the high prices.
And dealerships are making very enticing offers to people who trade in used cars right now.
In a lot of cases, people are actually making money on their used vehicles, and that has not happened in years.
Carla Bailo is president and CEO of the Center for Automotive Research. She says demand has also cooled a bit because prices are so high.
Consumers have very limited choice right now. Inflation has gone up in many other areas of their lives. So if you don't need to buy a car, now is not the best time to do it.
But things could get better for buyers soon, according to Jonathan Smoke at Cox Automotive, now that supply and demand are a bit more in line.
I believe that we're likely looking at the peak of retail prices this month in July.
Because, he says, retail prices for used cars follow wholesale prices, and wholesale prices dropped in June, and again in the first half of July. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
As I stand here in our New York studios, my thoughts turn to David Brancaccio, still doing the Marketplace Morning Report from his basement. No matter the source, though, check him out. All the business and economic news you need to get your day going. Infrastructure has kind of been a running joke the past couple of years, right? And it may well keep on being that, depending on how those negotiations in Washington go or don't go. But the reality, away from all the politics, is that infrastructure is a big deal. It's a big deal for the built economy. It's a big deal for the care economy. And it's a big deal for race and justice in this economy. Infrastructure that actually works for people where they are. The other day, I talked to Christopher Tyson. He's the president and CEO of Build Baton Rouge, that city's public-private redevelopment partnership. And I talked to him about what communities need and how that ought to figure into what kinds of infrastructure those communities get.
We know the history of redevelopment authorities and other kind of large-scale government-led urban renewal plans in cities has been a disastrous one. Indeed, the problems that I wake up every day and try to design strategies out of are the ones that previous iterations of urban policy created. What that means is that we must have an equity focus. We must have an equity lens. We have to realize we need a robust and well-equipped public sector to partner with private investment, to partner with communities, and to partner with others to make sure that everyone is included in the future city.
So when you go around and you have these meetings, or you're talking to folks on the street when you're, you know, passing by or whatever, Do they trust you, or are they justifiably jaded by experience?
Both.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll tell you, Kai, when I first encountered someone, when I took over this role and I told them that I was going to be taking over the city's redevelopment authority, the gentleman happened to be black, and I was meeting him through a mutual friend. He kind of reared back and said, "Should I be concerned?" And I said, "Absolutely." Mm-hmm. And what I meant by that is that I want the community to lean in. I want them to understand the policies and the politics and the finance and the aspects of what is happening in their communities, both how things became so blighted and so dysfunctional and how we fix that. And so anything we can do to heighten the awareness of our role and the tools that we have for everyday people, the better.
Is there a way you can see, and look, I know we've been talking about urban renewal in this country for a very long time, but is there a way you can see it getting anywhere without true public investment?
No, I worry that in the absence of a robust public role, that we will leave these issues of affordable housing, of infrastructure like mass transit and coordinating that with other development, that we will leave it to private investment, which obviously has to make a profit, which has to manage risk. And those risks can be steep. And so we can often design communities for condominiums and coffee houses as opposed to childcare centers and community health centers and fresh markets or grocery stores. And when you're trying to attract those needs that communities desperately want, there will be a financing gap, right? There will be considerable risk. And private investment is not going to swoop in to put a Head Start center in. A community needs childcare, and they need it on the transit line, and they need it adjacent to or in close proximity to quality, affordable housing and park space and sidewalks. And I can go on. But in the absence of that overarching plan and vision, I have very little hope that you will see a change that actually benefits the people who live there.
Well, it occurs to me, actually, that what you're talking about isn't urban renewal so much and infrastructure only in the most, you know, theoretical sense. What you're really talking about is building a community around what the people who live in that community need.
Yes, absolutely. And when we think about organizations like mine, and again, I always say equity focused because this is not your grandfather's urban renewal, right? this is a 21st century approach that is racially conscious, that is justice focused, that is rooted in history. And so that is what I see organizations like mine being able to do. And I think when you look around the country at organizations like ours, you'll see in the best cases that equity is being centered in the work.
Christopher Tyson is the president, also the CEO of Build Baton Rouge down in Louisiana. Mr. Tyson, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
She used recipes that her grandmother had used.
Grandma's recipes might actually be the ultimate comfort food, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Stocks rebounded today like Giannis Antetokounmpo, he of Milwaukee Bucks fame. The Dow Jones Industrial Average skipped up 549 points, 1.6%, 34,511. The NASDAQ added 223 points, 1.5%, 14,498. S&P 500 up 64 points, 1.5%, 43-23. Game 6 of the NBA Finals tonight. Now you see why I mentioned Giannis. However badly I mispronounced his last name. So why not look at a couple of companies based in the two competing cities, shall we? From in and around Milwaukee, industrial supplier Rockwell Automation packed on 1.9% today. Snap-on, the toolmaker, added 3% on the day. From Phoenix, grocery store chain Sprouts down 0.7%. Mining company Freeport-McMoRan found 1.7%. Bonds, just because I mentioned them up top, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note at 1.22% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were hearing earlier from Sam Fields about the supply of used cars out there. One thing about them, all those used cars we're buying, is that they can cost way more to keep running than something new off the lot. And if low maintenance cost is what you're after, what you might want to consider is a new electric vehicle. A report from the Department of Energy says that if you calculate the total cost of ownership, EVs beat gas-powered cars by 40%, a big part of which is maintenance. Now, is that going to make us in any more of a hurry to electrify our rides? Marketplace's Andy Euler checked in with a repair shop down in Austin, Texas.
It's early on a Friday, and Happy Hybrid has just opened its doors. The crew is already getting after it, though, changing the tires on this Toyota Tacoma. Next to the truck, there's a tiny little smart car up on a platform getting inspected, and a cluster of four Toyota Priuses are lined up outside. The shop's manager, William Broomfield, says about 60% of his customers drive cars with combustion engines, and 40% drive hybrids.
It's been working great with the hybrids. Most independent shops are very terrified of working on the vehicles. They're overwhelmed and they just won't even touch them.
What the shop doesn't see, though, are full electric vehicles. No Teslas, Nissan Leafs, Chevy Bolts. He says there's a few reasons for that. First, he says only dealers have access to replacement batteries for ones that go out. And also,
a lot of the fixes on these cars require proprietary software, downloads, and so forth. And so the customers are forced to go to the dealer.
And the other thing is that they have fewer moving parts, so they just don't require as many repairs. Cameron Proctor is an engineer who worked on an Energy Department study looking at the total cost of electric vehicles.
You don't have to change your oil. You don't have as many spark plugs and all of these different facets. You don't have an exhaust system, right? You don't. Many of these things don't exist.
Proctor says the main goal of that study was to answer a few simple questions.
What is going to encourage people to purchase an alternative fuel vehicle? Is it cheaper upfront costs or is it cheaper fuel prices? Is it lower maintenance?
Okay, now here's what the study found. Over the life of ownership of an electric car, an average driver will save about $8,000 on maintenance. And Chris Harto at Consumer Reports says, depending on how you purchase an EV, you could actually see savings pretty quickly.
You'll start saving money in year one, even though you quote unquote paid more. Your savings in fuel and maintenance will make up for the increased payment on that vehicle.
But even the director of the Vehicle Technologies Office at the Department of Energy, Dave Howell, says, unfortunately, that's just not what people think about when they're buying a car.
The upfront cost is a key. People buy vehicles pretty much based on how much it's going to cost them right up front, you know, purchase price.
He says as batteries get cheaper, so will upfront costs. And it's not that electric cars are maintenance-free, of course. They have wheels, brakes, lots of sensors, and pricey batteries. And then there's what the folks at J.D. Power call dependability, basically how many problems that car owners experience. In its annual survey, Tesla ranked 30th out of 33 brands. Dave Sargent is vice president of automotive quality at J.D. Power.
Most of the problems that customers report with Teslas really aren't related to it being an electric vehicle. It's much more due to Tesla being relatively new at manufacturing vehicles at all.
So he says Teslas have, you know, little squeaks and rattles and doors not closing right. Now, those are the kinds of things that William Broomfield at Happy Hybrid can help people with, even on an electric vehicle. But he's also not going to be able to charge a whole lot for that kind of repair. And his crew of eight mechanics aren't really trained to work on electric vehicles at this point anyway.
It's just another tech job. That's what it's turning into.
Broomfield studied sustainability in college and says eventually he hopes to be able to marry his two passions, cars and the environment.
I probably move away from, you know, the mainstream car and go to doing conversions on classics, like take a 65 Mustang and put a high power electric motor in it. And guess what? All of a sudden it's faster than it ever was with a gasoline engine. It's quiet, it's smooth, but you still get the look of the 65 Mustang.
Now, it's not going to sound like a 65 Mustang, but it's probably going to be cheaper to keep on the road and also a lot better for the planet. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace. Oh,
Did you do some stress baking during the pandemic? Sourdough maybe, or some sweet treats? And did you maybe think, I could sell these, start up a little side hustle? And then did you run smack into regulations ruling out exactly that kind of small home cook entrepreneurship? Illinois and some other states now say those home bakers can indeed be in business. From WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore reports.
Danielle Robinson operates Dottie's Kitchen, named after her grandmother, in her suburban Chicago home. She bakes blueberry lemon, cherry almond, and banana breads, selling them at area farmers markets.
My goal is to ultimately have my own commercial kitchen space, whether it be retail or in a warehouse situation. But just the cost for someone starting out and not really wanting to take on a lot of debt just didn't make sense to me.
Robinson is what's known as a cottage foods entrepreneur. They are home cooks who whip up shelf-stable foods such as breads, cakes, jams, and cookies. The Illinois State House passed a law this spring that will allow entrepreneurs to do deliveries and direct sales to customers beyond farmers markets. They can sell their products across the state without a $1,000 monthly sales cap. The law takes effect in January. By then, Robinson plans to retool her website and predicts she will be able to serve more customers.
I could just sell directly to them, whether it be delivery or pickup. So it really just opens up that access to them year round.
Robinson registered as a cottage food operator with her local health department. That's what bakers are supposed to do. In Chicago, only 22 cottage food operators have registered since 2017. But Beth Krieger says many operate around the state in secret because of the restrictions. She's director of a local branch of the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm. Illinois was behind some other states on home-based food businesses.
Illinois really had a patchwork of different laws in different places, and you might cross town borders and find that you had totally different opportunities.
The pandemic led people back to the kitchen where they dusted off heirloom recipe cards or tinkered with baking sourdough bread. Krieger recalls talking to a woman who simply wanted to sell bread from her front porch.
What could be more wholesome, more traditional? She used recipes that her grandmother had used. Her grandmother had sold loaves of bread to her neighbors, and she wanted to continue this tradition, but it wasn't allowed, and she could not convince the local government to pass a law allowing her to do that.
Krieger says she thinks more people will register when the law changes, and then they can advertise their businesses proudly without hiding. The state registration fee will double to $50. Florida also passed a law in June that gives home cooks more flexibility. Cottage food cooks start off small to see if they can scale up or experiment with an array of recipes. It proves to be economically feasible for budding home cooks like Carla Armore in Chicago.
A cup of yellow cornmeal. I'm going to...
She prepares cornbread in her Chicago kitchen. The recipe is half blueberry, half orange cranberry.
Can you do mom a favor, please? Can you go bring me the other buttermilk? I sure appreciate you.
In 2018, the home baker founded La Matrice, that's Spanish for the womb.
When you're baking, there's not a lot of noise.
Armour doesn't have the money to rent a commercial kitchen, so she is a cottage food baker at home.
If I can at least work from home and do that slow build to the point where I can get in to a rental kitchen.
And bake her specialty, scones. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore from Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Jeff Bezos said the quiet part out loud. Bezos, as you might have heard, became the second billionaire in space this morning, the 500-and-something person overall, 60 years after government employee Alan Shepard did the exact same flight, by the way. Anyway, Bezos went up, came back down about 10 minutes later, and in his obligatory post-flight remarks, said this.
I want to thank... every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this.
I mean, I guess we all kind of knew that, but still, man. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context on the way out. Comes to us from Sarah Cliff. She's a healthcare policy reporter at the New York Times, also an occasional guest on this program. Sarah points out in the paper today, a study out today from the Journal of the American Medical Association that says between 2009 and last year, medical debt was the single biggest category of debt that Americans owed to collections agencies. $140 billion in unpaid medical bills is in collections right now. Our daily production team is Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Bria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.